I call the meeting of the Environment, Natural Resources, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. A quorum is present. Representative Fisher, have you looked at the minutes?
Yes, I have, Chair Hansen. I have looked at the minutes. I move the approval for March 21st, 2023.
Representative Fisher moves the minutes for March 21st, 2023. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Ayes have it. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. First up, we have House File 2831. Representative Finke, Emerald Ash Borer Response Grant Program established and money appropriated. We have allocated about 20 minutes of time for this. Representative Finke, would you like to move that House File 2831 be laid over for possible inclusion?
Yes, that is my motion, Chair.
And Representative Finke, I believe you have a DE4 author's amendment, and I believe there are some technical changes from House Research you'd like to incorporate. So if we could maybe have Ms. Taylor just walk through that DE and note the incorporations as she goes through.
That would be great. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to walk through the DE4 amendment. It's a delete everything amendment. Section 1 is a reworking of the grant program that was in the original bill. Section 2 is a reworking of the appropriation this fills in the amounts providing $44 million total for the program. Section 3 is where the technical amendment would be. It'd be on line 2.27, delete everything after A, and this is just a technical. This language is no longer needed. And this provides some $4 million for plant in Shakopee. Section 4 would provide $1 million for school tree planting grants. This is similar to language from last year. And then Section 5 would provide $1 million for the Minneapolis Parks and Rec Board for tree planting.
Representative Finke, would you like to move that amendment with the incorporated changes?
Yes. Thank you, Chair. That's my motion.
Representative Finke moves the DE4 amendment with the technical changes to get the bill in the form she would like. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The DE4 amendment is adopted. Representative Finke, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Representative Hansen, or Chair Hansen, excuse me, and members. We had a presentation earlier this session on the Emerald Ash Borer. We spent considerable time on understanding this problem, which is not new. This bill would create the response, an Emerald Ash Borer response. We know we need to do something. This bill is our attempt to do something. It's in my mind, it's got a companion bill going to bonding, which is bonding requests for tree planting. There's also a few tree planting programs in the bill before us today, because we have to responsibly deal with the waste created by Emerald Ash Borer, and we need to proactively plant trees to replace them. So those are my opening remarks, and we can go to our testifiers.
Thank you. First up, Ken Smith, District Energy. And members, we're going to have 2 minutes each testifier. Welcome, and state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Ken Smith. I'm the President and CEO of District Energy St. Paul and owner of St. Paul Cogeneration. And I'm testifying in favor of this House File 2831. In 1994, the DNR published a report about wood waste in Minnesota, and at that time it said wood waste in urban areas presented a significant disposal problem. The Twin Cities had limited options, and it was leading to open burning and illegal dumping. Action by the legislature in that same year, 1994, eventually resulted in the development of St. Paul Cogeneration, the state's largest biomass fuel combined heat and power plant that was designed to use urban wood waste to generate electricity for Xcel and heat for buildings downtown St. Paul. That plant has consumed since 2003, when it went operational, 4.7 million tons of wood waste. Unfortunately, the plant is facing closure in 2024, and we're needing, and that's at a time when wood waste from EAB is rapidly increasing. When the policy and economic environment for biomass has changed and evolved, the need for this plant has not. The data shows that St. Paul Cogen is the most indispensable plant in the metro area dealing with wood waste. We're dealing with about two-thirds of the wood waste, according to a recent study that was published for Hennepin, Ramsey, and Washington counties. It actually stated without St. Paul Cogen's processing capacity, it's impossible to absorb the current material volumes through other offtake channels. A 2019 EQB report indicated that about 1.7 million tons of tree waste will be needed to handle in just the seven-county metro area from EAB. If this plant ceases operation, there is no realistic alternative in place or planning to deal with the 250,000 tons we use each year. The potential that this plant could close in 2022 caused the legislature to act in 2021, and that bill allowed us to work for 2 years under a PPA with Xcel that was approved by the Public Utilities Commission, and that allowed us time to try to find funding solutions to keep this plant operational. Originally, we were able to pass all of the cost of operating and using biomass on through our cost to Xcel and to District Energy St. Paul, but we can no longer do that. And so the plant is upside down financially. It costs more to generate the energy from it than we can collect in revenue. The limitation has also been placed on how much we can charge for the electricity to Xcel. That was part of the 2021 legislation. And so that, coupled with inflation, has made the situation financially unsustainable. Financial projections indicate that we need $20 per ton to make the economics viable. Now, we've had a lot of discussions about this over the years, MPCA, DNR, MDA, counties, cities, and a variety of stakeholders. And there's widespread agreement that this facility is needed to deal with tree waste. Without it, the volume of tree waste that manages will quickly overrun the remaining capacity options. And then it is expected the region will have to revert back to using open burning, producing significant air quality impacts. We are proposing the new grant described in the bill, $35 million, one time that we would pull, that we would use over the course of 7 years at $20 per ton. If we're using 250,000 tons of wood waste annually, that gets you to $5 million a year over 7 years, $35 million. The funding would preserve our ability to remain financially viable and operational during the period when MDA projects EAB will peak in the metro area. 7 years provides the certainty needed to make the investments necessary to keep the plant reliable and safe. It's important to note that with St. Paul Cogeneration operating, approximately 80% of the cost of dealing with 250,000 tons of tree waste is covered by energy sales. Without it operating, there will have to be something else done with all that material and the cost that needs to be determined. Action by the legislature was needed in 1994 to address wood waste and resulted in St. Paul Cogeneration. We strongly urge you to support this bill now to keep St. Paul Cogeneration operational. I want to thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. And we provided some extra time as we had a cancellation on the schedule. Victoria Reinhardt, Partnerships for Waste. Welcome, and state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair Hansen, members of the committee. I'm Victoria Reinhardt, Ramsey County Commissioner, and I'm Vice Chair of the Partnership on Waste and Energy, which is a joint powers board consisting of Hennepin, Ramsey, and Washington counties. I'm here today to provide strong support for House File 2831. Ash trees in over 40 counties, including Faribault County, which was just added this morning, have been found to be infested with emerald ash borer, or EAB, including all of the seven metro counties. It continues to spread across the state, creating a growing surge of wood waste that requires responsible management. District Energy's St. Paul Cogeneration facility offers the only practical option at this time to manage wood our residents bring to Ramsey County's yard waste site, which alone fills 1,000 semi-trailers each year. If the DNR commissioner decides to require a tipping fee as allowed on line 2.9 of the amendment, I would ask the committee to remember that will result in increased costs for counties and their residents. It is estimated at $20 per ton tipping fee. That would add to the county budget for just Ramsey County between $300,000 and $400,000. And we have already heavily invested in providing the service or the drop-off sites and so forth at no cost to our residents. So please bear that in mind. I would ask the committee to look at that. This is counterproductive at a time when we are asking the state for help in managing the overwhelming effects of emerald ash borer. As you've heard, District Energy's ability to continue to provide this critical function is uncertain after 2024, and we cannot afford to lose this option. House File 2831 is the solution we need at this moment, and we thank Representative Finke for bringing this bill forward. The grants to St. Paul Cogeneration and to local governments provided for in this bill will help slow the spread of EAB by reducing a cost barrier to remove the response and responsibly manage the affected ash trees so that they're not dumped or burnt. I'm actually at the end. Thank you.
Thank you. George Damian, Clean Energy Economy.
Thank you.
I want to reduce that.
Yeah, I did.
Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Hansen and members of the committee. For the record, my name is George Damian. I'm Director of Government Affairs for Clean Energy Economy Minnesota, or SEEM as we are known. We are an industry-led, nonprofit, nonpartisan organization representing the business voice of clean energy in Minnesota. Today, I'm here to testify in support of House File 2831, which will grant ongoing funding to clear, collect, and process the waste from the infected emerald ash borer, or AEAB waste. Specifically, this bill will allow District Energy's St. Paul Cogeneration Facility to continue processing this waste and turn it into energy. District Energy is already doing this work, and without their continued efforts in the arena, it is unclear what would happen to the hundreds of thousands of tons of EAB waste produced annually. This proposal is needed to meet the challenge of dealing with our state's EAB waste and putting it to productive use in the form of renewable energy. The main alternative to getting rid of this waste is open pit burning, which would be a massive source of greenhouse gas emissions. SEEM urges your support of House File 2831. It will be a key part of solving the major problem our state is facing with disposing of emerald ash borer waste, while also putting the waste to good use. We thank Rep. Finke for authoring this bill and looking forward to our continued work with you and other stakeholders to move our state towards a clean energy future. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. Kirk Kadelka, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Welcome. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Kadelka. I'm an assistant commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and work on land issues, including solid waste. Want to thank the committee for this hearing and the author for bringing this legislation forward. We support the need to properly dispose of wood waste and the large role that St. Paul SPC has played in this effort. We've helped advocate for the extending of the funding through the PUC process and worked and held various meetings with wood waste generators to find a solution to help the long-term viability of the location. So we appreciate the conversations we've had with the author earlier today and also with the company over the last few years. We know this is a very difficult conversation, but we want to make sure that all the options are on the table. I want to bring forward one additional one, and that is tip fees. We look at this issue through a lens of there are multiple parties benefiting from St. Paul Cogen, and so we also believe multiple parties should contribute to the solution. There are three main groups that are benefiting: Xcel Energy and its customers from renewable energy and baseload, district energy users that are getting the heat and steam, including where we are today, and wood waste generators. Only two of those right now, the first two, are contributing to the financial solution to this effort. Tip fees are a reasonable and credible path forward and should be part of the conversation as we look at a potential mix of solutions. This is similar to other waste processing disposal efforts that all have tip fees. Currently, for instance, if a $20 per ton tip fee was assessed, that would be less than other vendors taking wood waste at this time, including $25 at Shakopee, Milwaukee, and Sioux, $54 at SET, and $72 at Gertens, for instance. And so we know this is a challenging effort and appreciate the author bringing all the parties together, including the chair's earlier meeting. As he noted, these are going to be difficult decisions and we're going to have a plethora of solutions to move forward on this. And just want to make sure that the issue of tip fees is one that is discussed as we move forward. Thank you, Chair and committee members.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Amy K. Kerner, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources.
Good afternoon. I'm Amy K. Kerber with the Minnesota DNR, Division of Forestry, Outreach Supervisor. So current status of EAB, if you're watching the news today, it was just announced that the 40th County had a fine, Faribault County in the city of Blue Earth. And recently there was a find of EAB in Moorhead, which is Clay County, which is a significant jump to the northwest. With these new infestations, we have continued need in communities for financial assistance to support treatment, removal and replacement of ash, as well as addressing wood waste needs. The 2020 Environmental Quality Board EAB report had a variety of recommendations to help advance things in Minnesota. Highlighting a couple that deal with waste have to do with assisting communities and counties with developments to manage ash waste material in the highest and best way. In addition, incentivizing use of ash wood by energy facilities that currently have the ability to use biomass. Looks like both of those components are addressed in this proposal. Along those lines as well, in the governor's budget, I believe there's a recommendation within the PCA section for $4 million to help address ash wood waste. Also in the EQB report is a recommendation that we continue to fund communities for the removal, replacement, and treatment of ash. And that recommendation is for $8.5 million a year, ongoing for 30 years. The governor's budget this year recommends or proposes $7.6 million in FY24 and FY25 for community support to remove, replace, and treat ash, with ongoing at $400,000. This bill also includes an opportunity to plant more trees in schoolyards, which is something I think everybody can support. Schools across Minnesota have indicated their interest in having more trees on their school grounds. Provides an opportunity for schools to develop shade and nearby nature spaces for their students. There's many benefits to outdoor learning, makes lessons more relevant by using meaningful real-world experiences with the students. It increases knowledge gain and student achievement, develops young people's innate interest in the natural world as well. This grant aligns with existing programs in the DNR Division of Forestry Education programs, such as School Forest, Project Learning Tree, and Arbor Month. However, we support it with minimal staff, and so we would appreciate talking to the author about the opportunity for some administration support here. In summary, the DNR looks forward to working with the author on House File 2831 so that it can be implemented to help communities address wood waste needs and increase tree planting on school grounds. Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? Anyone else? Questions from members? Representative Jacob and then Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. So from what I can tell, this bill seems to be, you know, largely focused on the metro area. Really, while areas like my county of Winona County have already dealt with the issue with little to no public funds. So what's the plan going forward so that taxpayers from one area of the state aren't on the hook to deal with metro area issues?
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Hansen and Representative. This bill does largely deals with the wood waste from the 7-county metro area. I think it's fair to say that. I think that we need to dispose of that wood by keeping the only viable waste to scale program that we have in place. I don't think that the benefits of that are restricted to the metro area. I think if we open pit burned a billion trees, we would have some problems, however many trees it would be. I fundamentally have an issue with the idea that we shouldn't take care of our people in the metro area and take care of our neighborhoods and our trees and our health with taxpayer dollars.
President Jacob.
Yeah, so one follow-up question. Waste energy seems to me like a good solution. We implement that heavily in my area of the state. So I'm wondering, how would this program work if we lived in the carbon-free by 2040 standards?
Representative Finke.
I think that's a great question. Thank you, Chair and Representative Jacob. I think if you talk to the representatives that are here from District Energy, they will let you know that I was very interested in how we're going to answer that question, and not having a solution presented at this moment that extends longer than the EAB, because I do believe that 100% clean energy future is our future, and I do question whether or not burning trees is a real solution for clean energy. So I think that's a very important question, and we talked about that, and we had our conversations about that, because I support 100% clean energy.
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative. So biomass power is considered carbon-free at this point, carbon neutral at this point. And that is a determination both that EPA and the state of Minnesota supports that. So it is considered renewable, it's considered carbon-free or carbon-neutral energy. To the earlier comment, we actually take tree waste from about 22 counties. So while the majority of our tree waste is coming from the 7-county metro, and as EAB is hitting harder and harder, it actually is, so it's pulling in closer. We have in the past taken material out of Olmsted and out of that area because they just didn't have another place for it to go. There's now so much material being generated in the metro area that we just had to pull in closer.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative, well, actually Chair Hansen. So you and I have been kind of around the discussion with District Energy for quite some time. I think that both you and I have had folks from District Energy in our offices at one time or another over the last decade. And I'm very favorable to what District Energy does in resolution of this problem. But just kind of winding the clock back, because there was a time when there was legislation that lowered the rate per kilowatt, right? Mm-hmm. You and I were there for that. Did we create this problem? Did the legislature create this problem where now District Energy is financially underwater by statutorily cutting the rate that they were allowed to charge?
So I think we did create the problem for 10 years of not providing a response to prevent, to have a program in place. When Emerald Ash Borer came in 2009, I think the legislative investment was $2 million or $4 million. My memory gets a little foggy. And then it was zero, year after year after year, zero. No grants, no nothing. And the bug spread, and it kept spreading, and it kept spreading. And there were bills. We sat through these hearings. There were bills introduced, but in an era of austerity, then there was no money spent. Maybe a little bit on LCCMR, Environmental Trust Fund, but nothing of the scale needed to contain the areas. So what we have now is we have a massive amount of dead wood. And it is, all you have to do is drive around pretty much anywhere in the state, whether it's a farmstead windbreak, whether it's in a state park, whether it's on the Capitol grounds, whether it's in our neighborhood, there's dead trees. And the problem we've got is they're going to come down. And we waited too long on trying to contain that. And whether we had years of debate over treat or take, we did neither. We did neither. And so the trees, now we're stuck. So I do believe the legislature has responsibility in getting us in the mess we're in. There's a no-win solution here. I don't think it was the case on the rate. I think it was a case in not preventing and not reacting quickly enough with the dollars, like we did, frankly, as a state with Dutch elm disease in the 70s. We threw everything we had at it, and it wasn't pretty, but we stopped it. Stopped it or took it down. And so, unfortunately, we made the mistake of planting ash after those trees, and now we're stuck here. And we have to have a different approach of not the same trees, not the same species, not the same ages when we replant. And what Representative Finke has brought us is a comprehensive approach. I'll be real blunt. Do I want to give District Energy $35 million? No. I don't really want to give them $35 million. I would rather we were planting trees in that. But what are we going to do? So my constituents or all of your constituents, when they take the trees to the city dump, where do they go? That's not the end of them. They're going to him. They're going to District Energy. And if it closes, we have nowhere for them to go. So we are responsible. We're responsible for this situation we're in now. And we've got to solve this problem.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Representative Heintzman.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. So the question I was asking is, did the legislature's intervention into the rate paid by those in the service area of District Energy or XL Energy subscribers, did that result in this deficit, which now the entire state of Minnesota, every taxpayer in the state, is being asked, I think, to chip in to some extent. And I think that it's important to at least acknowledge that that likely created a problem that we're now having to talk about today. This may be the way to fix it, but it may not. And I think that on the record that needed to be at least acknowledged, that the legislature stepped in, lowered the allowable rate, and if I've got the information incorrect, if I'm remembering incorrectly, correct the record. But I think that that is the case. And so the elephant in the room, you know, as you're describing what the problem is that when District Energy was created and the rate was decided, the EAB problem was not present. So that really has nothing to do with my question or the bill before us, except that we're now trying to decide, well, who should pay? Should it be the ratepayers, or should it be taxpayers are across the state of Minnesota? So I don't know that this is necessarily the right approach. Representative Finke has some insight into that, I'd be interested, but there's a number of things that I think we could characterize as concerning in the bill.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to be very clear, Minneapolis taxpayers have paid for the removal of Emerald Ash Gore. The Park Board has had to use property tax levies to pay for the removal. And to be even more clear, the people of Minneapolis did not cause their trees to become infested with Emerald Ash Borer. And so we need to do something as a state about this, because right now people are paying for it. But this is a statewide problem. This wasn't something that the Park Board just introduced pretty little green bugs because they're pretty or fun or something. This was an invasive pest that happened. We need to take action about it. We have taken action, and the people of Minneapolis have paid for it, even though they didn't cause this problem. I think this is a good bill. I think it's important that we as a state take care of our assets, and that includes our trees. It also includes the waste that happens when we have to remove these trees. And so thank you, Representative Finke, for all your work on this. I also, I think this is important. I would also like to work with you a little bit more to work on how we can help with tree removal, especially for low-income Minnesotans who are often faced with a special assessment that happens when a tree needs to be removed from their property. So I know you have money in here specifically for the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board, which has done just yeoman's work on addressing the Emerald Ash Borer issue. So thank you for this work. But I do think that this is an important issue that does extend well beyond the metro. And this wasn't a problem that was caused by the metro. It wasn't a problem that was caused by Greater Minnesota either. But it is a state problem, and the state has the resources and should make sure that we're taking care of the people who live here and the trees that make their lives healthier and better.
And I would ask both the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Natural Resources to provide the committee with a list of where the grants that started in 2019 have gone. And they didn't start until 2019, and there's a reason for that. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Hansen, and for your remarks, Representative Jordan. And to your comments, Representative Heintzman, I don't disagree with a lot of the questions that you're raising, and I think if you talk to the stakeholders in this, I've had a lot of conversations about this, and I don't know if this is the right approach, but I have gotten to the point where I think it's the best approach. I wanted to come and plant trees. I wanted to be the tree lady, as Representative Jordan called me at the beginning. But that meant I wanted to plant trees, right? And having to deal with this problem, which is extremely complicated, and really nobody really wants to be fixing this problem in the circumstances that we have to. But that's what we're here to do, and we have to make hard compromises. And this we'll continue to work on this. I've had three or four more conversations just today since we drafted this amendment. So we're still working on it. But I do think it's the best thing that we have right now, and I think we have to do something.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Finke, you have $1 million for the Minneapolis Park and Rec Board for a tree planting appropriation. I know from my experience in Ely, we've replaced numerous trees in our park from the Emerald Ash Borer throughout our town. But again, we did, I think, what Representative Jordan said. We assessed our people and we paid for it. I'm just curious why just a million for Minneapolis, and do any other park boards in the Met Council area get any, or just them? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Scarpa. And to your question about the other park boards, I'm not sure if others are getting that, and that, I admit, is just because I haven't been involved in those conversations prior. I know that the Minneapolis, I mean, as Representative Jordan said, Minneapolis has been dealing with this, and a lot of people have been putting a lot of effort into a problem in the city that has been getting only marginally improved, and there's real need there, and I think that we can meet that real need. If somebody on the committee has more detail as to why this one is the one that's here, I'd be happy to take it. But I think that Minneapolis has demonstrated the need for this money to deal with this problem in a way that I want to be able to respond to.
If Mr. Rice could answer the question, and then we will be moving to a vote after that.
Sure. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Brian Rice. I'm an attorney and lobbyist for the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board. And I applaud you, Representative, and you, Mr. Chair, for bringing this forward. The Emerald Ash Board question is just major. It was almost 15 years ago that the Park Board came to this committee. Representative Loeffler worked on the issue, as you pointed out, Mr. Chair. Since from 2013 to 2021, the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board levied $5 million a year and removed 40,000 ash trees on public property. And we're directed to do that by state law. We're now in the process of removing an equal number from private property in the city. It was an enormous cost. We had asked for appropriations. Representative Loeffler was really a leader on this year after year. And I know that in southeastern Minnesota, it was Representative Davids in 2009 moved on the Florida Amendment for, and you were right, Mr. Chair, it was $2 million. Your memory, you might have more gray hair than then, but your memory is as keen as ever. It was $2 million. It came from legacy, and that was really the only significant appropriation to move forward. And I think this is a problem that we're going to face for a long time. And you write about the Dutch elm disease. The legislature in the 70s, I think, appropriated $20, $40 million over 2 years, and that was huge. So thank you. It's a challenge, especially in your district, Representative Scrave, but you know there's more ash in your section of the state than anywhere almost in the world.
Representative Scrava, and then thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just be brief. Yes, and it's kind of in greater northern Minnesota up there. We have a lot of with this issue. But I just go back to, I realize the city of Minneapolis spent a lot of money, as we did up there. I'm just curious why the taxpayers of Minnesota are going to reimburse them and not everyone else. That's all.
Mr. Rice.
Mr. Chair, I think the case would be that the, Mr. Chair, Representative Scrava, by bringing this issue forward and addressing it, I think the Park Board not only served its constituents, but all of the land around us. The Park Board owns land not only in Minneapolis, but in seven suburban communities, and we determined that this was and is and remains an existential threat to the tree canopy, not only the urban area, but greater Minnesota. And it was $40 million in an 8-year period to do it, and we'd ask the legislature to do it. We still have a lot of work to do. I mean, and I'm sure your community does as well. And we would support other communities coming forward too and asking for assistance, because it's real, it's a real and present danger and has been for decades.
The bill is being laid over, and we're not voting it out. It is laying it over. So, Representative Finke, you're willing to work with people as this moves forward? Representative Finke.
Yep, thank you.
And any closing comments, Representative Finke?
Thank you for the discussion. Thank you, Chair, for your work on the bill. This is a complex bill, and I've been having a lot of conversations. I welcome furthering them. We need to take care of this problem. We all know that it's complicated, but we have to take complicated work seriously.
Representative Finke renews her motion that House File 2831 be, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is being laid over. Representative Tabke, House File 2348, Shooting Sports Facility Grants Funding Provided. At about 5 minutes total, Representative Tabke. I will move that House File 2348 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Tabke to the bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And so this is a shooting sports grant, a facilities grant project. And so House File 2348, what happens is this applicants can request grant money on a first-come, first-served basis and require a one-to-one match. Grantees must allow members of the public to shoot at reasonable times and reasonable fees for 20 years after receiving a grant. So this includes $300,000 in grants for 24, $300 for 25. And I have, in order to keep things going quickly, Mr. Chair, I have a testifier here today.
Welcome. John Nelson, President of USA Play Target League. Welcome.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for allowing me to speak today. Unlike other sports, clay target athletes are not required to be the fastest or tallest or strongest or smartest or physically able or even the appropriate gender to participate on a school team. In fact, the only requirement for a student to be eligible to participate on a team in our league is to have firearm safety certification. Clay target is the most inclusive high school sport. It's also one of the fastest growing school sports in America. Of the 45,000 student athletes and 1,500 teams that participated nationwide in our league last year, 15,800 athletes and 420 teams were from Minnesota. That's almost one-third of the entire country's population. Or participation in our state. Minnesota hosts the largest shooting sports event in the world, the nation's only clay target state tournament that is sponsored by the State High School Athletic Association, the nation's largest two-year college clay target league, and the corporate headquarters of the largest youth shooting sport program in the world, the USA Clay Target League. Not only is the sport great for student athletes, their families, and the education community, it's great for the state of Minnesota. For fiscal year 2022, the Minnesota DNR received over $32 million, about 19% of their total budget, in federal grant monies from the Wildlife Restoration Act, the Pittman-Robertson, otherwise known as. What most people don't know is that 78% of those excise tax funds from firearm and ammunition sales are generated by recreational shooters, not hunters. Every single sporting event needs fields, pools, gymnasiums, courts, courses, tracks, whatever, has an opportunity to be developed on most any piece of ground in the entire state of Minnesota. Just try to name a sport that doesn't have a venue located in Minneapolis or St. Paul. Unfortunately, that opportunity is not so simple for outdoor shooting ranges. The demand for new clay target shooting sport ranges to be built and to improve existing ranges that will increase capacity has never been higher for Minnesota. So it is vitally important for the state to support this shooting facility grant and any future shooting sport venue needs as all of us continue to create the next generation of outdoor stewards.
Thank you. Tom Casey, Friends of the Minnesota Scientific and Natural Areas. Welcome, state your name for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Tom Casey. I am the board chair for Friends of Minnesota Scientific and Natural Areas. We provided a two-page letter as our written testimony for the record. The end of our letter lists some organizations and a notable individual who signed on to our support letter. With limited time, I'll point out two of them. The first one is the Minnesota Division of the Isaac Walton League, and the second one is someone I'm sure familiar with, and that's Mr. Carol Anderson, who, as you recall, testified last week on the lead issues pertaining to the Minnesota Swan Protection Act. So I'm going to briefly summarize my letter. First of all, and I really want to emphasize this, is we support shooting sports as an important part of our national heritage. We support shooting sports. But second, however, we're concerned about the present language of the bill, and we've informed Representative Tabke about this prior to our meeting today. Simply stated as written, the taxpayers will subsidize the proliferation of toxic lead in the environment, as written. So our written testimony provides language that would add two conditions to the grant. First would be that the facility uses non-toxic ammunition only, and second, that the facility provides an educational component regarding the toxic effects of lead ammunition and the non-toxic ammunition alternatives. So in conclusion, these grants, subject to the two conditions I just mentioned, will provide incentives that will enhance the reputation of the shooting sports facilities as conservationists. It will enhance the reputation already, even more so as conservationists, and will allow people to participate in this ever-growing sport without adversely affecting the environment. So in closing, we'd be honored to accept an invitation with Representative Tapke and others to refine the bill so they can move forward and protect Minnesota's natural resources and people. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify for or against the bill? Anyone else in the audience? So we have Representative Liz Lagarde and then Representative Scrapp. Representative Liz Lagarde.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Tapke, thank you so much for bringing this bill forward as is. I would support it as you written, so thank you so much. This is good for the state, it's good for the kids, and it's something that we need to continue. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Scrapp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Tapke, as a trap shooter myself, this is very good to see. Our high school has a team. My community college in our community has a team. We get to work with these kids all the time, helping. Nothing greater than seeing how many women are involved now in trap shooting and getting involved and how great of a shot they are. I mean, it's phenomenal. It's just awesome to watch in our community. One of the things I'm looking for is, is there a reason why you're not asking for $1 million? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative
Tapke. Mr. Chair and Representative Scrava, we are working to be very fiscally conservative in the DFL side of things this session. And this was what came forward from the advocates as to what they would like to see and what the demand would be for this program. So that's what we went with at this time. But there's always a future change that we could make to it. Thank you.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Tapke. I'm curious your response to the second testifier and their suggestions.
Yep. Representative Tapke.
Mr. Chair and Representative Purcell, yes, I absolutely hear exactly what they're saying. I think it's important that we continue to work to minimize lead in the environment for sure, but this bill is not the appropriate place to do that, and happy to work with them on other things in the future.
Representative Purcell. Representative Tapke, any closing comments?
Mr. Chair and members, thank you very much for the bipartisan support for this bill. It's really good. Shakopee has a trap shooting team, and they do really great work, and it will help folks all over the state. So thanks to Representative Heitzman and Representative Brand. I think Representative Schultz are all on the bill with me as well. And so I just appreciate the support and bipartisan support in this moving forward in the omnibus bill.
I renew my motion that House File 2348 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. House File 1130, Tapke, cities authorized to adopt pesticide control ordinances. I will move that House File 1130 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Tapke, to the bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. To continue with the absolute love fest on my bills today, we've got, is that what it's going to be? We have House File 1130 today. So this is a bill that is supported by city. So I'm a former mayor of Shakopee and support local control anywhere that makes sense and works well for the state and for those communities. So what this bill does is really a very simple bill. It allows cities to make choices that eliminate and restrict the use of pollinator lethal pesticides in their community. So this is not a bill that affects the entire state. This is not a bill that makes any changes right now. What it is if a city wants to eliminate the use of pesticides in their community, it allows them to do that and have local control over those decisions, Mr. Chair.
And you have a couple testifiers. Aaron Roop, Pollinate, Minnesota.
Do 2 minutes
that
each.
Lovely. Hi.
Hello, Chair Hansen, members of the committee. My name's Erin Roop. I use she, her pronouns. I run Pollinate, Minnesota. I'm a mom of two kids. I'm a constituent of Representative Jordan's. I'm a beekeeper. I started my organization to offer experiences with honeybees as a teaching tool for schools. I've connected with 40,000 Minnesotans with live honeybees since I started this work. The bill before you today has a dual history. In Minnesota, this bill was introduced in response to a pesticide kill of my hive at a school in 2013. I teach with honeybees. I offer these classes to everyone, mostly kids. Children deserve opportunities to be with insects, to deserve to see the cool things that they're expert in their own neighborhoods. And insects are struggling right now. In the places that we've tracked, total insect biomass has gone down by 75% over the last 30 years. Minnesota beekeepers lost, on average, 58% of our colonies this year. These declines have only grown since I lost that hive in 2013, in spite of your significant taxpayer investment over the last decade, because we haven't taken the necessary steps to mitigate pesticide exposures that this bill would allow cities to take. Current legal pesticide use isn't just harming kids' teaching tools. Legal pesticide exposure causes devastating health outcomes in Minnesota, and I encourage you all to read Bonnie Wirtz's heart-wrenching testimony closely. The second story is that in the late 1980s, pesticide drifted onto a school bus, harming the children inside in California, and the county there changed their pesticide law to be more protective in response. The pesticide industry then went state by state, passing pesticide preemption laws, state by state, all but 4 to 6 states, maybe, all in an effort to prevent counties from protecting their own children. And I would encourage you to think about why that happened. My last point, I'm going to skip. I'm grateful for you all for demonstrating your leadership in so many ways here in Minnesota, and I encourage your support of these small steps towards change today as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Daniel Papineau, True Green.
Thanks.
Welcome. State your name for the record.
Yes, hello. My name is Dan Papineau. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for True Green. In the interest of being efficient and timely, I included some information about our company with my testimony. I'm not sure if it was included or not, but I did submit it. HF 1130 looks to grant local governments the ability to regulate certain pesticides in order to protect pollinators. The policy goal of protecting pollinators is an admirable one. We know the threat pollinators face. It is evidenced by countless studies identifying lack of habitat, parasites, the transportation of pollinators long distances for mass pollination events, and yes, pesticide use as threats to pollinator health. Reviewing testimony, amendments, and engaging with many of the proponents of this policy, I felt it was necessary to come before you to raise a few concerns, pose a few questions, and provide some clarifications on HF 1130, all of which are meant to promote a better bill and not to dissuade you from your continued efforts in protecting pollinators. First, pollinators all over Minnesota are important, not just the ones in cities, and statewide solutions for that protect pollinators exist and do far more for pollinator health than this bill. I urge the committee to consider these options. Second, the bill as introduced included many exemptions, and amendments continue to be discussed to include more. This process seems piecemeal and suggests a more thoughtful, collaborative approach is necessary. Pollinator lethal pesticides are used everywhere from your backyard to your child's head when they get head lice. The committee should know the uses and benefits of pesticides and the drawbacks of them thoroughly before they turn over authority to local governments to regulate them. Third, True Green specialists are all licensed, certified, and trained in pesticide use, and there is special emphasis within this process on pollinator protection. Specialists are trained, educated, and tested on pollinator health every year and throughout the season. While we are licensed, certified, and trained, True Green doesn't use anything different than what an everyday homeowner could pick up at their local hardware store. If a city bans a pesticide within their border, it will only lead to a massive increase in applications being performed.
Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify for or against the bill? Questions from members?
Mm-hmm.
Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. So I see the exemptions here for mosquito control district for public health protection. And first of all, do we know, is there neonics in mosquito control chemicals?
Representative Tappy.
Mr. Chair and Representative Jacob, I do not know that for certain, no.
Okay. Does the chair know that?
Representative Jacob, most of the mosquito control district pesticides that are applied are Bacillus thuringiensis, Israeliensis, I think, BTI, which is put in a briquette that they're actually out putting in the marshes right now. Very little adulticiding is done. The neonicotinoids, so it's actually a living thing that is put in a briquette, dropped in the marshes, and works on the larva. It's a larvicide, but it's alive. And if there's anyone out there that would want to counter or confirm that, but very little adulticiding occurs. And again, most of the neonics are either a seed treatment or an injection application.
So follow-up question then. I see exemptions for mosquito control in the metropolitan districts. What about statewide? Say like, you know, city of Winona, city of Rochester in my area. Is this just an exemption for the metro area or is this statewide?
Mr. Chair and Representative Jacob, this Metropolitan Mosquito Control District is an entity in the metro, and no one has approached me with any other mosquito control districts across the state. I would have been happy to put them in there if anyone had requested it. So if you know of anyone that needs to be added in here, this is being laid over, and we can absolutely work on that.
Thank you.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Tabke. I might ask for the Department of Agriculture if they're available to comment on this bill. Just curious about the Department of Agriculture's perspective on this bill.
There are several people here. Mr. McAdams, are you? You can state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, committee, my name is Roger McAdams. I'm the Assistant Director of the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division, overseeing the regulatory. As far as this bill is concerned, it really does not impact the Department of Agriculture because it only gives cities the ability to ban or restrict a certain mechanism. Our only role is we are required to put together the list of pesticides that would have those requirements on the label. That's the only impact it has to the department.
Thank you, Chair. And so hearing that and hearing that that does have some jurisdiction, and I'm reading a little bit that it does, is the plan for this bill, is it going to go to the Agriculture Committee, and or what's the path for this bill?
Representative Schultz, it was heard in the Agriculture Committee and came here based on the path that it took 2 years ago.
Thank you. No further comment.
Representative Gilman.
All right, thank you, Chair, and thank you so much. Just for this opportunity just to ask really a couple quick questions in regards to pollinators. I think about when we think about mitigating pests that could cause unwarranted problems like Lyme disease, things like that. So if a city does ban or a county city bans this product, could people still not go to a big box store, get things that they need to apply to their lawns? And who's going to regulate that? That's what I'm just curious about. With just the prevalence of Lyme disease in Minnesota, you know, our family's been impacted by it. And just curious about that.
Yeah. Representative Tappy.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gilman, what I think is the great thing about this bill is that it doesn't require anyone to do anything. So if a city wants to, if a city chooses and desires because they think it's the right thing to do for their residents to ban a list of use of pollinator lethal pesticides, they can do that, and they will discuss with their residents and have a robust discussion at that point as to what makes the most sense for their community. So they can choose, and they don't have to do things. There's no prescribed results in this bill whatsoever as to how people have to interact with this and can use it. It just allows them to, and they can go through a robust conversation with their community and figure out what works best for them at that time.
Representative Gilman.
Yeah, I'm just, you know, I do love the idea of local control, but I'm concerned, you know, again, when we talk about pollinators and different things and what actually is impacting our pollinators in the state, it's not just pesticides. It's other diseases. Climate change, we talk about climate change here, can impact hives and the health of hives. Different diseases, things like that, that impact bee health. And I really am concerned that if we bring this to certain towns and cities that where a small board may make a decision in the impact on actually physical health of people because of the other things that these chemicals can take care of, you know, the harm to our dogs with Lyme disease, you know, different things like that. And I'm concerned that we should have more talks about how this could impact a lot of our communities, not just in the city, but rurally, like in a big way.
Representative Tapke.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gilman, yeah, for 90% of what you said there, I completely and totally agree. There's absolutely a lot of different pieces that all go forward with this, and I absolutely trust local governments to have those discussions with their communities. And if you look, you mentioned dogs and Lyme disease. The first piece that is exempted on here is pet care products, and so that's on here. We, as Representative Jacob knows, and we had a big discussion in ag where we added some more. I don't think they were completely necessary, but they were other items that added comfort language for folks to be who were concerned about things. So, like on the ag side of things, it exempts ag land use from this, and so that makes sure that if there's any sort of invasive noxious weeds or anything like that, that is able to get taken care of. But I fully, with this kind of decision, I fully and completely trust that local jurisdictions will be able to take care of those decisions.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And then Representative Heinzman.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schultz kind of covered my question, but and I really was curious about, you know, Department of Ag's role and where this was going after environment. I'll just make a quick comment. As the delegated authority, I'm just kind of, I guess my concern is, does the Department of Ag have that authority to delegate the federally delegated authority from EPA? I don't know. It just seems uncertain to me whether or not MDA has the authority to delegate this to the cities, but it just creates such a patchwork of regulations across the state, and especially in light of the commercial applicator testimony we had today, I just have concerns about how people are going to apply this. But my questions were answered. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Just looking back at line 2.4 and then following that up with the exemption for the Metropolitan Council or Metropolitan Mosquito Control District, excuse me. I think that Representative Jacob was trying to drill down on that a little bit and figure out, is it necessary or maybe is there a better way to do that? I just want to make sure that others may not be negatively impacted in looking for an exemption down the road. If I'm...
Representative Tapke.
Chair Hansen and Representative Heinzman, I'm not following your question. I'm sorry.
I'll try again, Mr. Chair. Okay, would a city outside the 7-county metro area that adopts the ordinance under this bill be able to use the same pesticides used by the Metropolitan Mosquito Control District? That was the question that Representative Jacob was asking, and you said that there was nobody else that had asked for an exemption. Mm-hmm. Well, things have been happening fast, Representative Tapke, so there may not have been an opportunity. Maybe the bill could be written so it was a little bit easier to avoid those potential conflicts down the road. That was my suggestion, if that is potentially a conflict.
Chair Hansen, Representative Heisman, yeah, I very much hear what you're saying. Mosquito Control District is a very specific entity, and so if another community, so communities can choose how they move forward on this. And so if they want to adopt it and they want to exempt if they have a mosquito control district, which I don't know if there are any in the rest of the state, and I'll research that when we are done here. Is there? Mm-hmm. Okay, so we can absolutely exempt find out who that is and get those exempted on here as well. In this same, but the local community can also exempt that on their own as well as they're adopting an ordinance.
Closing comments.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
We got Representative Fisher. Sorry.
That's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Tabke, for bringing this forward. I think it's very important that we have this opportunity for local cities to be able to do this type of opportunity for their communities. Now, we've heard over time where we have the issues around our pollinators. I mean, we've heard this in committee now for as long as I've been on the committee, which is almost 10 years, that there is a problem with the insecticides and what it's having an impact on our pollinators that are out there. And I think for local communities to be able to have that opportunity to say, hey, we want to be friendly, they should be able to do that. And particularly when more and more people are realizing that as this comes out, they're getting educated and realizing we shouldn't be using these chemicals to help make sure that we protect our pollinators. So thank you for bringing this forward and giving the cities the opportunity to do this for their citizens.
Closing comments.
Thank you, Chair Hansen, and members, thank you very much for the conversation today. I will, this is being laid over, so I'll find the language that we need to make sure that other mosquito control districts are included in this, and we'll move that forward. So thank you very much for your support, Mr. Chair.
I renew my motion that House File 1130 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over.
Next on our agenda is House File 1317. This is a Representative Hansen bill, as are the next couple. As he approaches, we will have a number of testimony. We have a number of testifiers on this bill, and I will be keeping a time for that. That will be held at 2 minutes. But to start with, Representative Hansen, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd move House File 1317 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Representative Hansen, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 1317 is following a similar path as it did in previous years. Chair Vang's committee has heard this as well already, as it has done in previous years. This bill has been around, and it relates to seed treatments and disposal. And we have had testimony in front of this committee in prior years looking at the issue of how do we properly dispose of seed that is treated with pesticides. And the challenge has been that you have seed law and pesticide law, and there's a gap between those two. What this seeks to do is to have our agencies working together, and then it would provide for setting up and clarifying who's responsible. It has rulemaking on the disposal side, being with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and the seed side being with the Department of Agriculture. It has prohibited disposal methods. It has money for consumer guidance and rulemaking. And with that, I know there are a number of testifiers.
There are. First on my list is Chris Cowan from the Pesticide Action Network, and then on deck is Margo Monson. Mr. Cowan, please come on down, state your name to the committee, and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Chris Cowan. I'm a contract lobbyist with the Pesticide Action Network. We generally try to keep pollinators, people, and our environment safe from pesticide use. Just a few notes. On a previous bill before this committee, I think last week, I made reference to how this bill got started in a way a couple years ago regarding nationwide or continent-wide treated seed disposal at the Alton ethanol plant, and I made reference to their to a marketing email, and that is in your packets. You can see how that worked. 98% of all discarded seed was going to that plant, and that was going on for about 6 years. And in general, you know, why do we bring these bills forward? Why do we support House File 1317? So two things that I would ask that for you to consider. Take a look at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture 2021 Water Quality Monitoring Report and just see the amount of pesticides and the number of pesticides that are showing up in our groundwater, in our well water, in our surface water, and even in our rainwater. And then I did something today is that I took a look at the Department of Agriculture's budget, and I just did a word search for the word pesticide, and here's some of the things that I came up with, which to me points to a general concern about pesticides. The budget references pesticide monitoring, pesticide in private wells, pesticide waste, pesticide in surface water, pesticide drift and misuse, pesticide groundwater, pesticide concentrations over time, pesticide exposure, detectable pesticides, pesticide compounds, pesticide issues, pesticide risk, pesticide contaminations. We have a lot of water in Minnesota. We also have a lot of pesticides, and I think now is the time to consider a bill such as this one, House File 1317.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next on my list is Margaret Monson, and then on deck is Pierce Bennett. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Monson. Please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
My name is Margaret Monson. I live in St. Paul. I'm an entomologist and a beekeeper. Chair Hansen and members, the news of the disaster in Meade, Nebraska that Chris Cowan just mentioned is still really vivid in my mind because of the disturbing photos and the scope of the environmental destruction that took place near the ethanol plant. In fact, it turns out there have been many environmental violations since it opened in 2015, but the plant continued to operate as a free drop-off for leftover seeds and saved farmers disposal costs. As early as 2018, residents began finding fermented corn seeds in the fields near Meade that were being applied to the soil as amendments to boost soil fertility. But in actuality, they were waste from the Alten plant that contained high levels of the neonicotinoids, leftover seeds from all around the U.S., stored outside in green piles covering as much as 30 acres. Residents had to keep their windows closed due to the stench. Animals that were living outside were starting to have neurological problems. Then in 2019, state regulators found liquid waste stored in lagoons on site, and the test revealed that the neonics there were over 5,000 times the safety levels. Regulators closed the plant in February 21 within a week, a pipe ruptured, sending 4 million gallons of wastewater into Meade's rivers and streams. Fungicides and neonics then were detected 40 feet below ground in drinking water wells and as much as 6 miles downstream from the Alten plant. Professor Wu Smart, who works at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, reported that entire honeybee hives within 3 miles of Meade died. Today, 2023, the seed waste remains at the site, covered in a mixture of clay, cement, and polyester. Professor Smart reports it is still leaching neonics into the aquatic systems. Fish and beaver kills have been reported, and neonics and fungicides are now being detected in tadpoles and blackbird eggs that live near the facility. And they're still dealing with persistent and widespread bee losses today. The EPA suggests it's going to take many years to clean it up, but there have been no processes discussed for cleaning it up.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on my list is Pierce Bennett, and then on deck is Amanda Billick. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Bennett. Please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, members of the committee. Representative Hansen, good afternoon. I'm here to testify to share some concerns on behalf of the Minnesota Farm Bureau Federation, where I serve as Director of Public Policy. My name is Pierce Bennett. Specifically want to talk about just use of these products and why farmers utilize them. And it is an important decision in their operations when they're choosing to use this technology. It's often utilized in a way to try to decrease amount of spray pesticide and also used as a way within precision agriculture to narrow down the scope of what they're doing when they're making these planning decisions. Specifically today, I just want to point to some of our concern around some of the future labeling requirements and if that could disrupt access to these products in the future, specifically that process being worked alongside with the EPA as they would be helping to define or approve new labels, and what that would mean if we have a Minnesota-specific label and there were to be a backup of product or ever needs where farmers were trying to get these seeds outside of the state of Minnesota, and if that would disrupt their ability to do so in the future. And so that's one of the main concerns we see here at the Farm Bureau, and just want to reiterate that, you know, our farmers do their best to protect the environment and be stewards of the land, and they utilize products in this way to try to do so. And we would encourage, you know, members of this committee and others to think of that as we're discussing bills like this and make these decisions. And look forward to continue having this discussion on this piece of legislation with the committee and Representative Hansen. And thank you all for your time today.
Thank you. Next on my list is Amanda Billick. Please proceed. And then on deck, I have Bruce Clevin. And Ms. Billick, please correct about the pronunciation of your name. State your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Amanda Billick, and I'm the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Corn Growers Association. Thank you for the opportunity to provide a few brief comments on House File 1317. The Minnesota Corn Growers Association, we represent nearly 7,000 corn family farm members, and we do have a few concerns with the bill, which we've discussed with the author previously, which we appreciate those discussions. In order to keep this brief and really within the jurisdiction of the committee, I just want to make a couple comments on Section 8 of the bill, which is beginning on line 4.1. We agree that all of the prohibited disposal methods that are listed should be avoided to dispose of unused or unsold treated seed. MCGA and our members do take seed stewardship and the responsibility of agriculture pesticides and fertilizer very seriously. That includes the seeds that are treated with pesticides, whether they are being used for the current planting season or it's unused and or unsold treated seeds. So Section 8 proposes to add these prohibited disposal methods to the waste management chapter under the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's jurisdiction. And we think it would be more appropriate to add these prohibited methods to the Minnesota Department of Ag chapters, either the pesticide control or the seed chapter. And we make this suggestion just for the simple reason that if a farmer has a question about the proper seed disposal or of unused or unsold treated seed, they're more likely to contact the Department of Agriculture than the Pollution Control Agency. So we hope to continue working with the author as the bill moves through the process. And thanks for the opportunity to provide a few brief remarks today.
Thank you, Ms. Billick. Last on my list is Bruce Clevin. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Clevin. Please introduce yourself for the tape and then proceed with your testimony.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Bruce Clevin. On this bill, I represent the Red River Valley Sugar Beet Growers Association. We actually have a dog in this fight because our industry uses treated seeds on the sugar beet fields. In fact, we're number one in sugar beet production here in Minnesota. I'm just going to talk about two sections, Section 6 and 9. In Section 6, this requires a guidance document, and I just want to bring to the members' attention that the PCA did that. I did not prepare this as a handout, but they did this last year. It was in March of 2020. It's a decent piece of paper. It's got the landfill information on the backside and so forth. I know I'm talking to Representative Hansen that this is probably not as binding as he would like it. It's been done. But just to bring to the committee's attention that number Section 6 is not going to be very hard to comply with for the agency. It's already been done. And then on Section 9, and this is related, and this discusses the rulemaking. Commissioner PCA must adopt rules providing for the safe and unlawful disposal of waste treated seed. That's probably not a bad idea in and of itself. Kind of pulls in that guidance document. The issue I'm going to raise, though, is in the next sentence. The rules must clearly identify the regulatory jurisdiction of state agencies and local governments with regard to such seed. It just seems like this is a little backwards, where it would maybe be the legislature's call to decide who's going to do what. You've got Chapter 18B for pesticides, 21 for seeds, and 115 for PCA solid waste. So it just seems like that maybe should be a call the legislature makes versus having the agencies decide what their own authority is going to be.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on this bill? Okay, we will go to questions from members then. Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Chair. Is MPCA around? I'm thinking they are.
I believe they are. I will let someone from the MPCA to come down, hopefully. And Representative Heinzman, as they approach, why don't you ask your question?
Yeah, we'll see if I can say it loud enough so we can get it going here. I'm just wondering how long it's going to take, and is the $175,000 appropriated going to cover the workload and the cost?
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Dave Benke. I'm the director of our Resource Management Assistance Division at the PCA. We did respond to the fiscal note request for this bill, and for our rulemaking process, we took a look at what this would entail, and believe that the $175,000 will cover that.
Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Chair. The other half of that was how long do you think it was going to take? And maybe that was covered, but I missed it.
Madam Chair, Representative Heisman, apologize for missing that part. The average rulemaking takes approximately 2 years to conduct in, from start to finish. This would be a fairly focused area, and it might take long, you know, less time than that. But that's what we anticipated in the fiscal note in terms of time and cost.
Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Chair. Just one last question, and probably for Representative Hansen. We've talked about this before, but just to discuss it one last time. Just how common is incineration? This bill keeps coming back, and I think that the number of cases that this has been an issue is relevant, and so if we could just quickly go over that again.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Heinzman. I think the actual answer to that is we don't know. We don't know on how much open burning, we don't know how much backyard burning, we don't know how much corn furnace in the shed there is, and I think that's where the opportunity for having the agencies work on getting the word out so we can do that, because that's probably where the proximity to people is. You know, we didn't know what was happening in Nebraska until it happened, and then we found out that Minnesota Seed was going there. We've said many times in this committee, prevention is better than cleanup. Prevention is better than cleanup. I would note, since Representative Heinzman, that you were asking about a fiscal note, Section 3 would be my intent to delete Section 3, which was added in Representative Vang's committee, and that's where a large amount of cost came in the fiscal note. So as we do markup, I would be removing Section 3.
Representative Hansen.
Representative Chair.
Representative Heinzman.
It's not your fault. I ruined it yesterday when I couldn't remember my own name.
Yeah. And you're all confused. Go
thank
ahead.
You, Chair. Just finally, to confirm, who's responsible for enforcement of this provision, and what do we expect that cost to be?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative Heinzman, that's what the bill would do. That's why it's here, because the PCA has disposal. This is primarily a disposal bill, but we want them to be working with the Department of Agriculture. That's why it went through Chair Vang's committee, to clearly define what happens and when.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Chair. So which of those two agencies are responsible for enforcement, Representative Hansen?
Representative Hansen.
Are they both?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's the problem we're trying to resolve, is we're giving that responsibility to rulemaking to clarify when one stops. Right now, the Department of Ag has the responsibility for the seed. Their pesticide authority only occurs when the pesticide is applied to the seed. That is the application. The Pollution Control Agency has the responsibility for disposal. When does that disposal start? And so we're defining in the bill unwanted seed, not seed that maybe is going to continue to be used. As you may know, sometimes the seed comes back, gets repurposed, and is used for food plots, distributed out. That's still a viable use of the seed. It may be given away or for a nominal fee. When you determine that you're no longer going to use that seed that's been treated, then how does that comes into the Pollution Control Agency. And having that in rulemaking, rather than me just saying that here, and when we first brought this up, the agencies had challenges responding to that. I appreciate that they have done the fact sheet, but fact sheets come and go, commissioners come and go, legislators come and go, and we need to get this clarified, not only for now, but in the future.
Representative Heinzman, and then I'm going to go to other members.
Nothing further.
Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Jordan. So I guess maybe more of a comment than a question. As a farmer who plants treated seeds, I keep track of literally not how much of a bag of seed I have left, but how many seeds are in each bag, how many seeds it takes to cover each acre of ground. The price of that seed is astronomical. I'm not going to let one of those seeds get away from me. And if I have a part of a bag left over from one year to the next, I'm calculating that into my next year's. Have we seen that it could be a problem? Potentially, but it's a very valuable product. I don't I can't see myself or any of my neighbors or constituents in my area doing anything other than putting that seed in the ground as it was intended for.
Representative Hansen, response and closing comment.
I appreciate your stewardship. I think that's something we can try to encourage for a lot of people, but right now there's been confusion, not a lack of clarity, and differences in perceived authority. This bill, I think, helps solve those problems, and I would renew my motion to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 1317 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill, and the bill is laid over. Next on the agenda is House File 2564 from Representative Hansen. Representative Hansen, would you like to move the bill?
I would move House File 2564 be laid over for possible, or this one is laid over for possible inclusion. This is the DNR policy bill, and I have with us the agency, Commissioner Myers. Welcome.
Welcome back to the committee, Commissioner Meyer. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. For the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. House File 2564 is the department's annual policy technical bill. Actually, it's a little bit more than the annual bill because it contains some provisions from last year as well, so we can call it the biannual policy bill since we weren't able to get anything passed last year. It really focuses on three categories, several categories if you have your fact sheets in there, improving DNR business policies and practices, elk and deer management, natural resource improvements, and taking care of what we have, expanding issues for people with disabilities. I'm going to run through each section of the bill relatively quickly, describing those, and if we have questions, I can either take them, Madam Chair, as they come up or at the end of the walkthrough.
I think we'll go to questions once we go through the entire walkthrough. So why don't you go ahead and proceed?
Thank you. Section one of the bill allows us, it falls under the category of improving DNR business policies and practices. What it really allows us to do, and we had this last year, to invest the funds that we receive from permittees with the State Board of Investment to generate increased revenues off of those funds for financial assurance practices. This practice came to us as we were reviewing some financial assurance options for permitting projects in the past, and one of the recommendations was to have that money earn money for us while we have it in our possession. So this would allow us to work with the SBI at a very low risk investment opportunity to provide some opportunity for those dollars to earn some money. Section 2, Section 3, Section 4, and Section 5 of the bill deal with a language that you've already heard dealing with the removal of registration decal numbers on snowmobiles. We've been talking about this for several years with the Minnesota United Snowmobilers Association on an opportunity to increase the actual registration decal on the machine that contains your registration number, name, address, phone number. There's a scannable code on there for our officers to use as well, in exchange for removing the MN2482 number that a lot of people with snowmobiles these days don't have. They aren't designed for a clean panel to do that. So unfortunately, a lot of people have these on their machines, but if you buy a new one, or you can peel them off if you want to. So those sections will apply to that. And we do have the programming ongoing within our ELS program, and MinUSA does support those sections. Section 6 of the program deals with improving our business practices sections of the bill, and really it removes a barrier in the naturalist program, or Minnesota Naturalist Corps, that was established shortly after legacy programs came on board. It provides some technical language, but the gist of it, you'll see, is in Section 7 of the bill, which deals with eligibility. We want to remove some language that requires a person to be a permanent resident of the state, to be a scholar in a college program in a field related to natural resources, cultural history, interpretation, or conservation, and then that language that says complete 1 year of post-secondary education. These are often entry-level internship programs within our parks, and we want to expand them to be more inclusive and including for people who may be students of the state of Minnesota but not a resident, or things like that fall into the qualifications. Section 8 of the bill is language from last year. We're working with Representative Ertl on this provision. It would allow the Loose Line Trail to go into and include a connection to Green Leaf State Rec area down in the Wilmer area. Section 9 allows us to set practices or fees for camping, lodging, day use facilities, tours, educational programs, seminars, events, and rentals within state park system, the same way as we establish camping and lodging fees. So it would be by commissioner's order and looking for that authority to do that. Moving on to section 10, this is a provision from last year's bill dealing with timber permit postmark date. The goal is to reduce late payments by loggers. So rather than base the date of the payment on the day we received the mail, we were basing it on, you'll see, on the date the it's postmarked. So mail in Ely, for example, probably isn't a daily event sometimes, so it, depending on the weather, right? So we want to make sure that we're allowing loggers flexibility and receiving our payments at the same time. Section 11 of the bill clarifies wanton waste, and it defines wanton waste to provide greater protection to all native fish species. So right now, wanton waste refers to all non-native fish, and really we want to make sure it doesn't apply to the common carp and really focus on those carp disposal options that we're dealing with. Section 12 allows us to expand the walk-in access program, which is extremely popular throughout the state of Minnesota. This actually conforms our program, which is funded federally, with the federal changes that have recently occurred to allow bird watching and wildlife photography. There's a piece at the end that allows us to do some conforming rulemaking as well related to that. And you can see that we're also striking the term in Lions 9.10 from hunter walk-in access hunter validation just to walk-in access validation. Section 13 of the bill we've discussed previously as well. It expands opportunities for people with disabilities based upon a wildlife management area accessibility report that we did several years ago. It expands opportunities for, you'll see on 9.16, other power-driven mobility devices. There's all sorts of them that are out there. The two-wheel traction devices, a four-wheeler could be considered an OPP DMD, to allow people that are disabled to use these devices. Not only disabled hunters, but people with disabilities. So the gist of this is changing the term from disabled hunters to people with disabilities in those sections, and then deal with our authorities that we have there. Section 15 of the bill deals with takings permits. It streamlines and conforms federal and state regulatory taking requirements for long-eared bats. Section 16 of the bill improves equitable access to the outdoors by allowing tribal members whose identification cards show state residency to use that identification to purchase hunting and fishing licenses for the state. Section 17 expands glazed orange requirements to ground blinds. We've recently had several hunters who've escaped death in their permanent ground blinds, luckily. But by having them with blaze orange will hopefully reduce that liability. Section 18 clarifies that youth deer tag can only be used by youth hunters, not anyone else. Section 19 deals with that as well, talking about the subdivision does not allow the taking of a deer by another member of the party. Section 20 removes prohibitory language allowing the use of muzzle loaders for all rifle seasons. It does not relate to the shotgun zone, which if somebody were to look at that, they would think we're maybe changing the shotgun zone, but we aren't doing that. Section 21 is a section in the bill that we would like to work with the chair and the committee on removing. I've been working with Representative Burkle on this issue. Rather than completely striking the language, we would like to have a stakeholder and outreach program take place this summer to talk with constituents and property owners on our elk management options up there. Section 22 deals with provide for non-lethal hazing of deer and elk. So it's trying to prevent elk damage by deer and elk, which is a huge issue for us right now. We're trying to work with producers and the Cattlemen's Association on those issues. We'll be coming back next year with more language. Section 23 removes unused authorities for managing whitefish and catfish via seining. We do not allow that, but it's currently in statute. Section 24 would allow two lines to be used for fishing in the Minnesota and Mississippi rivers. It comes to us from our catfish angling subgroup within the Department of Natural Resources. Section 25 deals with fish harvesting clarification. You'll see there's a number of these, striking the word to, T-O, and including the word through, add catching that last date of those dates. 26 deals with a prohibition on felt-soled waders to reduce aquatic invasive species, supported by Minnesota Trout Unlimited. 27 deals with the whitefish and Cisco language. 29 is that through, two through pieces that we talked about. 30, 31. Deals with that piece as well. 32 is the same thing. Section 33 adds tribal governments in our public water work permitting review, so it would allow tribal governments to review applications for public water work permits within their reservation boundaries. And then Section 34 deals with that as well. Section 35, rulemaking, it's good cause rulemaking exemptions to update our rules with the exact statutory changes contained in the bill. Section 36 is the same thing. And Section 37 is a repealer for an antiquated piece of statute dealing with removal of dead fish that we no longer use. Sorry for the quick rundown, but I know you have a lot of things on your calendar. So.
Well, thank you, Commissioner Meyer. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on the bill? And we will go to member questions then. I have Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, I wanted to thank Commissioner Meyer for his efforts to change the elk management language we talked about last week after talking with my folks up north. And the trajectory of the elk depredation claims, it's just good to know that we can work on that in the next year here. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you have removed certain provisions for taking fish with seines, smelt, how do they get smelt?
Commissioner Meyer.
How do they get smelt?
I mean, can you use a seine for smelt?
Yes.
Is that?
Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry. It says remove certain provisions allowing the DNR to take fish with seines, nets, and other devices, including no longer taking whitefish or catfish. Okay. You remove that. Stand corrected.
Commissioner.
Thank you. Thank you.
I think he answered his own question.
Yep. Thank you.
Any further questions for members? Representative Hansen, closing remarks.
This is the policy bill. We will be including that. I renew my motion. House file 2564 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 2564 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill, and the bill is laid over. Next up is House File 1680 from Representative Hansen. Would you like to move your bill?
I will move that House File 1680 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
And Representative Hansen, I believe you have the A1 author's amendment. Would you like to move your amendment and explain it for the committee?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move the A1 amendment. What the A1 amendment does is it looks at a cumulative issue in terms of water sustainability. 1680 came to us from the administration. We have added on line 1.7 of A1 cumulative withdrawals again on the to the commissioner, and then the commissioner may consult with health, agriculture, and the PCA when determining impacts on water quality and quantity. So I move the A1 amendment.
Representative Hans moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form he would like. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. And the motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen, to your bill as amended.
As I discussed, this was an agency bill. The A1 amendment came from me, and I have the Department of Natural Resources here to describe the bill.
We do. First on my list is Katie Smith from the Minnesota DNR. Welcome back to the committee. Please restate your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, committee members, Katie Smith, Director of the Ecological and Water Resources Division at the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Thanks for the opportunity to be here today.
The variability of Minnesota's climate and geography means that rainfall is not always available in the quantities we need at the times when it's most needed. Minnesota businesses and communities need dependable and reliable water supplies. And while water levels fluctuate naturally throughout the year and across multiple years, intensive water appropriation can push the low levels lower more often, significantly reducing stream flows and more frequently putting fish, wildlife, plant communities, and riparian uses at risk. Our ecosystems are important to Minnesotans' way of life and a recreational economy. Therefore, DNR is proposing some revisions and additions in statute that relate to water management. The proposed changes were described in a report to the legislature in 2016 after extensive stakeholder engagement over several months, and we could make that report available to members. The bill components, it adds definitions in statute that define negative impact, ecosystem harm, and sustainable diversion limits. It modifies statutory language for authorizing groundwater use by incorporating the definitions when considering groundwater appropriations. While the current statutory language for groundwater use requires protection of surface water ecosystems, it lacks clear definitions of what constitutes a negative impact. The proposed additions and revisions are a recognition of the fact that many of Minnesota's surface waters are hydraulically connected to groundwater resources. The surface water provisions in Chapter 103G.285 are related to direct appropriation of surface water and can be managed by suspending permits under certain conditions. But permit suspension does not translate in a meaningful way to the diffuse and distributed impacts of groundwater use. The delay between action and a response in water levels is too slow. It could be weeks, months, or even years, and adds a great deal of uncertainty for groundwater users. There's a strong scientific basis for maintaining the natural dynamic patterns of surface water bodies by establishing protected flows for individual streams, protection elevations for individual basins, and target hydrographs for wetlands. So what implementation might look like, the sustainable diversion limit would be defined in terms of a protected flow or elevation for one or more water features. A groundwater model would be used to determine whether existing and or proposed cumulative groundwater withdrawals in the area, drawing from a combination of sources, including stream flow and aquifers, are likely to exceed the sustainable diversion limit. And if those sustainable diversion limits are exceeded or are likely to be exceeded, then the DNR would establish a planning process involving stakeholders and permittees to evaluate water use priorities and determine options to adjust appropriations and stay below the diversion limit. Individual appropriation permits would be assessed in relation to the cumulative limit, and if necessary, appropriation permits would be adjusted at specified intervals so that the cumulative withdrawal limit is not exceeded. Thanks for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Director Smith. Last on my list is Tony Quillis from the Irrigators Association of Minnesota. Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Quillis. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tony Quillis, and I'm representing the Irrigators Association of Minnesota this afternoon. Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to make a couple of brief comments on House File 1680. I think it's important when we talk about the definitions under the groundwater statute to think about the entities that hold the groundwater appropriation permits. And they range from agriculture communities, municipalities, cities, industrial complexes, all hold those permits. And then to think about the state also and the regions of the state. Southeastern Minnesota is different than northern Minnesota. The metropolitan area is different than central Minnesota. And so to think about that when we talk about the groundwater appropriation permits and how these definitions change, specifically the ecosystem harm. And on 1.9 where it talks about a loss of ecological structure or function, it's a pretty broad term there, and there's no timeline or time frame around that. It doesn't say whether it's permanent or temporary. It doesn't say whether it's seasonal or potential or actual. So it creates uncertainty among the regulated entities. And so we're going to keep trying to work with Representative Hansen and the Department of Natural Resources to provide some clarity around these definitions, because the ecosystem harm then goes into the negative impacts, then goes into the sustainable diversion limits, which then get put into that statute between groundwater and surface water. So if we don't address the confusion that's caused by ecosystem harm, then it just feeds itself through the House File 1680. So we just want to make sure, again, we'll keep working with Representative Hansen, the agency. We've had some preliminary conversations. I think we have the same shared goals. And to make sure to provide some clarity and just make sure as we're looking at the models that those models, the data that comes from there are peer-reviewed and scientifically based. Madam Chair, and thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Questions from members. First on my list is Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hansen. Looking at this bill and hearing the testimony today and how this is based upon that 2016 report and the conversation here, just wanted to see with this bill and the direction that we're headed on this piece of legislation, are we headed for a place where the permits that are sought here, the process to receive those permits will go any bit faster?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Schultz, I have the DNR here, could answer that question.
Director Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, the DNR would still continue to go through its normal process of assessing sustainability and potential impacts. We always strive to review permits in as timely a manner as possible.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just hope that we can continue to provide certainty for those who seek to work with the DNR and our stakeholders across the state. Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
I think it'd be good to make sure we have sustainable diversion limits. So some of our other states in the union are getting thirsty. And we want to make sure that we have procedures in place to prevent either going in one large tank or pipe or in millions of bottles leaving the state. So having these diversion limits, I think, is an important step. I understand where you're coming from, Representative Schultz, but we also, as we deal with climate and changes in water all around the country and the world, we need to protect our resources.
Further questions from members? Those sound like closing comments to me, Mr. Chair. Any further closing comments?
I renew my motion that House File 1680 be as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 1680 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill, and the bill is laid over. Next on the list is House File 1862 from Representative Hansen. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would move that House File 1862 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Members, what this does is it removes county board approval for, if you will look on the repeal, for land acquisitions relating to scientific and natural areas, critical natural habitat, and wetlands for wildlife. I have been asked, who brought you this bill? Why do you have this bill? Whatever. I think the answer is really why, as one subunit of government to the state, have the authority to veto a land transaction between a willing seller and the state. It's actually kind of a libertarian position, I think, of why should the government step in and have to give approval for that transaction. So that is the bill, fairly simple. I know there are some testifiers. I think the DNR is here.
That is the first testifier I have on my list, is Assistant Commissioner Meyer. Please restate your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony. We are running low on time, so all testimony will be limited to 2 minutes.
Madam Chair, if it's okay, I would like to bring up Mr. Todd Patzer with me as well.
That works fine.
And then he can start, and I'll follow up after his testimony.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Hansen and members. My name is Todd Patzer. I'm a county commissioner in Lacaparle County in western Minnesota. County boards do play an important role in state land acquisitions. The role in that process is there for a reason, and that's to ensure that land acquisitions for public purposes consider local impacts to the people and economies and communities where they are being done. In most cases, county boards just approve the purchases, agreeing that they are a good fit. There are rare occasions when concerns are brought forward, but even then, sales are generally approved. In my own county, just a couple times in my 18 years on the county board, there has been some local concerns that the county board felt were not being considered. And county boards do not have final veto power. The Minnesota Land Exchange Board can approve the sale, and in their history, they have never ruled against the DNR or the U.S. Fish and Wildlife in a proposed acquisition. Last year at a meeting of that Land Exchange Board, Governor Wall stated his desire for the DNR to work with counties to find common ground when concerns are raised. The DNR, under the leadership of Commissioner Stroman, has done exactly that. They came out and met with us, and we're making a lot of progress in those relationships. Land passing from private to public ownership has long-term land use implications. The state recognized that when it established these procedures nearly 40 years ago. People through their local elected boards deserve to be heard when a significant land use decision will impact their community, and I encourage you not to take that voice away. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you for your testimony. Commissioner Meyer, do you have more to add?
Madam Chair, just briefly for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. Commissioner Patsy did a great job talking about how important the relationship is with the counties, and that is paramount with the Department of Natural Resources on all of the work that we do. We value and appreciate our work with county boards throughout the state, and we do not support this provision. Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on this bill? We'll go to questions from members. Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Jordan. So, coming from 10 years on the county board, this has come before us many times. And whether it's the county dealing with a township on returning a road to a township or land acquisitions, any of those pieces, anytime we can have what we consider to be full, willing participation, it really sheds a good light on government working together. When you take the position that, okay, the government has this authority, we don't no longer need to ask that local or even interact with that local unit of government, it just adds seeds of unnecessary kind of distrust. So the system seems to be working good. I don't understand what it is that we're trying to fix.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and to the testimony as well. There's nothing in the bill that says stop collaboration and communication. But what the law says currently, and what I'm trying to change, is that a local unit of government can intervene in the sale of a willing seller to the state. We represent the state. And it's been there a long time. Things change. I like that the communication is going on. But in this situation, you have a local government who can say no. And going to the State Land Exchange Board, you have a whole intensive purpose here of responding to this particular issue. I think it can change, particularly for scientific and natural areas.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hansen. I, you know, especially coming from my previous experience on the congressional level and seeing PILT across northern Minnesota, I'm concerned with this bill and taking that local control away, simply because there is an advance of land that is transferred to the state, and so that's my concerning facet to this bill. I just wanted to just see if there was any, you know, particular problem that you were trying to get at here with this bill.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The problem is that you have a local unit of government who can intervene between a willing seller and the state.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Hansen. I think that we have there's a shared interest with county governments, local governments, and you know, when we consider those lands, they're quite vast in northern Minnesota, impacts a lot of people, and certainly the county tax base and others, and so I think that in particular is why it's important that counties have a say when you consider the impact that it has directly to county budgets.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With a willing seller, you'd also have to have a willing buyer. And that's where the collaboration can come in. And the state does not have to buy that. You have to have two. But not, what is now, we have three.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Chair. And just to kind of wrap this, Representative Hansen, throughout the committee today, members presenting bills were advocating for local control. Now we're not. This more directly affects greater Minnesota, and now local control apparently doesn't matter. Nothing further.
Representative Hansen.
I renew my motion that House File 1862 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 1862 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill, and the bill is laid over. Members, we have two bills left on our agenda today. The next one is House File 1283. Representative Hansen, would you like to make a motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move House File 1283 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Representative Hansen moves that House File 1283 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill, and I believe you have author's amendment as well. Would you like to explain it and move it?
I would move the DE1 to get the bill in the shape I would like, and what this does, since the bill was introduced, the federal government has acted. We have heard of testimony before about the federal government would act. They have acted, so I am clarifying with the rules for water quality standards to be the federal definitions of the PFAS contaminant chemicals. So this is the actual specific chemicals that are in the federal government, and then it also has the health risk limit for PFOS, PFOS.
Representative Hansen moves the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the form he would like. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails, and the DE1 amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This provides, I think, some clarity in terms of standards for water quality. You will find a fiscal note that has the cost in there, in addition, definition of rulemaking for those. We provide quite some time for this to occur, and I think this helps protect the public and our environment. I'd ask for your support.
There are two testifiers who have signed up in advance. First on my list is Ivana Stark from Clean Water Action. Second on my list is Tony Quillis from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Please come on down, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed with your two-minute testimony.
Chair Jordan and members, I'm Ivana Stark, State Director of Clean Water Action. First, I'd like to thank Representative Hansen for this bill. It encompasses everything Clean Water Action stands for: clean, drinkable, fishable, swimmable water. It is a no-nonsense approach to doing the right thing to protect Minnesotans now and for the future generations, especially as scientists are increasingly saying that they believe no level of the PFAS chemical class are safe. Throughout this legislative session, you've heard testimony from people whose lives have been stolen from them. They or their loved ones are facing horrible, sometimes terminal illnesses, and they suspect these are linked to PFAS exposure. Even once these people that you have heard from are considered healed or in remission, their lives are forever altered by constant pain, the reminder of missed life events due to hospital stays, and scars that will forever be on them physically and emotionally. We've got to get our priorities straight. We have to protect the water we make our infants formula with, the water we use on the fields that feed us, and the water we bathe and swim in. Remember, the more that these chemicals find their way into your body, the more they bioaccumulate inside you, and you are at risk. Water is a fundamental basis for all life. We have an opportunity to protect the one thing we all depend on. This bill will save lives and taxpayer dollars. Minnesotans have been loud and clear, and they demand action. You can give them safe water that they are seeking, and I urge you to support House File 1283. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on my list is Tony Quillis from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Welcome back to the committee. Mr. Quills, as you're walking down, please state your name for the tape and then proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Tony Quillis from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Want to thank you for the opportunity to make a couple of brief comments on House File 1283. As Representative Hansen has pointed out, on March 14th, the EPA came out and announced that their national primary drinking water standards will be set for PFOA, PFOS, and then four other what's known are GX chemicals. The PFOA and PFOS maximum containment level was set at 4 parts per trillion. That's the lowest level reliably measured. And then for the other four Gen X, they're using a hazard index. EPA is going through their process right now. As a matter of fact, on March 16th, they had their first general overview webinar. On March 29th, they're going to have their technical overview, and then on May 4th, they're going to have their public comment. They anticipate all of this is going to be done by the end of 2023. I think it would be prudent to let the EPA go through there and let our state agencies learn from that experience. And Representative Hansen is also already under the DE1 amendment waived 14.125, which would put the gets rid of the 18-month requirement on the state agency to do rules once published, Mr. Chairman. But I just think that it's going to be a difficult process because we have some site-specific ones right now, and now we're going to go statewide. So it's why I think letting the EPA go through their process would be prudent. But, Madam Chair, the most concerning part for me is Section 2. And it sets a very dangerous precedent for the legislature to go through and start setting health risk limits in statute or in law. There is an open and transparent process right now in rulemaking. It allows public comment and stakeholders input, Madam Chair. And I just think that when we go through and set that limit in law or statute like this, the legislature changes hands over the years.
Thank you for
and
your testimony.
I just think sets a very dangerous precedent.
Thank
so thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Welcome to the committee. Ms. Lovell, please state your name for the record and then proceed with your two-minute testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Lovell. I'm the Legislative Director at Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. At the risk of sounding like a broken record, I'm here to tell you once again that PFAS is one of the biggest environmental and public health problems of our time. The nation is looking at Minnesota to see how the origin state of PFAS is going to handle the problem. National attention on our PFAS bills have made that clear. This bill on setting PFAS water quality standards would build on an initial step in MPCA's PFAS blueprint to start monitoring influent wastewater treatment facilities and look at industrial dischargers. That would allow us to address point source discharges from wastewater treatment plants. Appropriating needed funds to the MPCA would allow them to create science-based water quality standards for PFOA and PFOS. Designating a water quality standard allows for the designation of impaired water and gives MPCA more tools to address pollution. Rulemaking is a process that ensures that the best peer-reviewed science is used and the public and all stakeholders have input in the process. This bill is critical to move forward on addressing our problems with PFAS. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Anyone else in the audience? We'll go to questions from members. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Chair. MPCA available?
Seems as they are as they're making their way to the table. Why don't you ask your question?
Thank you, Chair. Just would like to confirm the timeline for the bill. Is that workable? And do you have any concerns? Is there anything here that creates a problem for MPCA?
Mr. Johnson, please state your name for the record and then try to help us out here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Tom Johnson, Government Relations Director for MPCA. We feel that the timeline, especially with the Section 14.125 not applying, is workable for us. So, and overall, these are chemicals within the family that we're familiar with. And there is science available to evaluate these, we believe.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Chair. Could you also speak to the standards that are being offered in the bill or through this process and how they might align with what the federal government is doing right now?
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The federal government draft MCLs, or maximum contaminant levels, are for drinking water. These would be for surface water standards under the Clean Water Act, so just under different parts of federal law, and this would be our state implementation of the Clean Water Act side. So we'd be developing standards for one of a few different potential goals, whether it be for aquatic life or for drinking water or for just general fishable, swimmable uses.
Representative Heintzman.
Nothing more at this time. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Perhaps Tom, sorry, last name.
Mr. Johnson, sorry,
Madam Chair. No problem. I was reading the letter from League of Minnesota Cities, Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, and again, being the mayor, former mayor of Ely, when there was a violation, I would get the letter because I was on the permit. The concern that the communities have, and rightfully so, is when we set the PFAS, what the percentage is, there's no way that we know of right now to take them out of the system. And they're not using them. They're not putting them in the communities, the people that the system is. So how are you can set the standard, but what are you going to do to the communities? And that is a concern of mine also. So if you could, please. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, that's an excellent question, Representative Scraba. And I think we also are very concerned about the impact that PFAS is having to municipal facilities that are just receiving the PFAS, right, and it comes out their tailpipe. We know that there's challenges for how to treat for PFAS. It will be difficult. There are technologies that exist. They're very expensive, though, prohibitively expensive. You're absolutely right. At this point, we would expect that cities could apply for variances where needed, because we do allow for, if there is no economically feasible way to treat for this, they would have that type of option to apply for a variance.
Representative Scraba.
No, that's fine. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hansen, closing remarks. Representative Wislegard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the MPCA, so I would go to industry then, right? Would that same standard or variance be allowed for industry? Because if industry is not successful, right? So if it's truly about the environment, you can't say one doesn't have to meet the standard, but yet someone else does. So would industry get the same variance?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, I think economically feasible is different for municipal facilities versus industry, depending on the industry, certainly, but it could be.
Representative Wislegard.
I'll follow up afterwards. That needs more exploring, what that means.
Representative Hansen, any follow-up and closing remarks?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and you know, I think what this all does is say, we've got to get this out of our environment. We've heard multiple bills relating to constricting the use. PFOS in Section 2 has already been constricted from the environment. And I would draw your attention to line 1.14 and 1.15, where I think folks would want to know whether they're upstream or downstream or receiving the water. In amending the health risk limit for PFOS, Commissioner must comply with Minnesota statutes section requiring a reasonable margin of safety to adequately protect the health of infants, children, and adults. And that is a 2025. We have a 2026. We have a lot of work to do here, The federal government is starting to act, but this stuff is everywhere, and they've let it go on too long. So I think there was something in the paper a while ago or in the media. Often it takes a long time to get rules and these limits done. But this is, we need to, the federal government is starting to act, and we need to be concurrent with them. So I'd ask for your support, and I renew my motion, House File 1283, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in omnibus bill.
Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 1283, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. As we are shifting around, Representative Meyer, come on down. Representative Heintzman, would you like to move House File 2745, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill?
Madam Chair, I would move that House File 2745 is laid over for possible inclusion.
And Representative Meyer, get comfortable. You're doing some important work, it seems, over there. Welcome to the committee. To your bill.
So moved.
Thank you, Chair Jordan. I'm passing a little snack out because this is my first time that I've been in this committee. And, you know, I guess I want your attention because I'm the last bill of the day. So House File 2745, I'm calling it the Keep It Clean bill. And I just want to thank Chair Jordan, Chair Hansen, members. You know, this bill has bipartisan support, and it's got a lot of statewide support. And it's about protecting our waters. So in my district, we have Lake Minnetonka. It's the heart of my district, and for years, I've worked with local organizations, local businesses on cleaning up the lake. Sometimes this means that we jump on somebody's boat. Sometimes some of these bigger organizations get together and they rent a barge, and then we end up diving for garbage. And it's always amazing how much garbage you see out there. You know, we take a lot of pride in protecting our waters, both for environmental reasons, but also for economic reasons. What House File 2745 does is bring our litter laws up to date on our frozen lakes and waters, which will protect water quality, our fisheries, and our lakeshore. In my community, there are a lot of public parks on the lakes, and they get dirty. This is gonna require that waste and garbage be placed in containers that are secured to ice shelters, motor vehicles, conveyances, not placed directly in the ice or state waters. From the information you guys have seen, this will be enforced by DNR, and I know we have a couple testifiers here today. I think you've seen there's been a lot of letters in support of this. Ron Shara actually did a video in support of the Keep It Clean campaign. Not going to show you that because we only have 15 minutes. But I'm asking for your guys' support here today. And I know we have a few testifiers.
We do. I have two testifiers on this. First up is Robin Dwight from the Upper Red Lake Area Association and Keep It Clean. Welcome to the committee. We actually have a hard stop at 5:15, so we're going to keep testimony very brief to 2 minutes, and I will be timing. And so, welcome to the committee, Ms. Dwight. Please say your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Hansen, for the opportunity to testify before the committee today. I'm a fast talker. My name is Robin Dwight. I'm the president of the Upper Red Lake Area Association and one of the spokespeople for the Keep It Clean initiative. Our initiative began over 10 years ago at Lake of the Woods to address the growing problem of garbage and human waste as a byproduct of winter angling and recreation on frozen lakes every winter. Concerned Mille Lacs Lake and Upper Lower Red Lake stakeholders joined their efforts within the last 2 years. Together, we represent the three largest Minnesota walleye fisheries. 38 lakes and other organizations across the state have joined our initiative since then because they see the same leftovers on their waters and their shorelines, and they also lack the resources to provide sustainable solutions. At Lake of the Woods, there's been a 500% increase in the fishing pressure from 1981 to 2020 during the ice angling season, while summer angling pressure remains fairly constant. This trend reflects similar trends on other ice belt lakes and coincides with the introduction and increasing popularity of RV-style wheelhouses. With a good understanding of the number of people visiting our frozen lakes and with evidence of what they leave behind, our Keep It Clean committee began to work, both locally and regionally, to bring about the changes we believe are necessary and sustainable. At Upper Red Lake, we had town hall meetings to learn how we could work together to change culture and human behavior. We collaborated with nonprofits and agency folks who agreed with our mission and who subsequently provided support and funding for our media campaign and human waste removal pilot program. We provided resources to lake businesses and developed our own media outreach through a new Keep It Clean website and Facebook page to encourage lake visitors to change their behavior and bring trash and waste off the lake. Thanks to partnerships with local businesses, Keep It Clean at Upper Red Lake operated a fairly successful pilot program this winter. Anglers and winter campers on Upper Red contained and delivered over 23 tons of human waste to designated dumpsters separate from solid waste collected by access owners on shore as part of the Keep It Clean human waste pilot program. At Lake of the Woods, Mille Lacs Lake, and Upper Lower Red Lake, businesses are sharing our messages and using our resources. Keep It Clean is provided. In spite of our efforts, we still see evidence that too many people have little to no respect for our natural resources and who continue to ignore local ordinances, taking the easiest way out with their trash and sewage. Anglers and sportsmen who have enjoyed a lifetime of fun on the ice are sometimes the same folks that leave a trail of waste and aware that their small contribution adds up. There are others who don't mean to pollute the waters, but who arrive unprepared to remove the trash that freezes to the ice before they move their shelters.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Stick around for questions. Next on my list is Colonel Rodman Smith from the Minnesota DNR. Welcome back to the committee, Colonel Smith. Please reintroduce yourself for the record and then proceed.
For the record, Colonel Rodman Smith, Director of Enforcement, Department of Natural Resources. Madam Chair.
Please proceed.
Madam Chair, I'll keep it real quick. We'd like to thank Representative Myers for bringing this forward. The Keep It Clean initiative for working on this as well. We fully support this, and I'll stop there so we have time for questions.
And we do have a number of questions. First on my list is Representative Brand.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I guess I just have a comment. I just want to thank the chair for hearing the bill. I had requested that we heard the bill. I'm on the bill. I think it's a great bill. I watched Ron Chera the Minnesota Bound a couple of weeks before you actually showed up to my desk on the floor asking me to sign on to the bill. And it was a bunch of kids that were out there as part of a school project to clean up Lake Waconia. And they found a whole bunch of stuff, including what's on this page here. I think that we have to do better. We must do better. Our water is a public used just like a sidewalk or a street or anything else. And we want to make sure we keep it clean. And I appreciate this bill. Thank you very much.
Representative Lislegard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the representative. This is a wonderful bill. Thank you so much for bringing it forward, and thank you for the candy. I needed it.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Myers, for inviting me to sign onto the bill as well. I have a question about the $25 as the fee, and I'm wondering how you landed on that as the dollar amount.
Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Chair Jordan. Thank you, Representative. Working with DNR to better understand what you can do with, a petty misdemeanor. I think the fine can go up to $50, but it was from the advice of them of what they can do along with some of the fees. I think this is a good place to start. I don't know if.
Colonel Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, it is kind of unique to have a $25 fee on a petty misdemeanor. Normally, in statute, it would just say a petty misdemeanor, and then the DNR would go to the Council of Judges for the bail schedule, and we would request from the Council of Judges for the bail schedule what that fine amount should be. It might be a little bit more than that, so we can work with the author as we kind of move forward on whether or not we want to get rid of the $25 piece and just keep it at a petty misdemeanor.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you. That was helpful for me, and I think as this is a problem in my district too. I think there are varying degrees to which this waste is a problem. So if it's an accidental, beer can stuck to the ice, it's not great. But if it's the tons of human waste that we heard about, that maybe the $25, it's not a one size fits all. So that's just my comment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions from members? Representative Myers, any closing comments?
What I would say is thank you for hearing the bill in such short notice. It means a lot. Thanks for everybody that signed on to the bill. I've given you my number one treat when I am out ice fishing. And a lot of times, that's you bring your favorite candy bar and stuff like that. And that's the type of garbage and waste that is left behind. So, this... So, I I truly believe this bill is moving in the right direction to make sure that we are protecting our water, so I appreciate you guys hearing the bill.
With that, Representative Heintzman renews the motion that House File 2745 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill, and the bill is laid over. Members, good job staying on target today. Chair Hansen, any closing comments or roadmap or anything for the committee?
Well, Mr. Strohmeyer, we'll be posting on Monday, walking through the bill on Tuesday. There'll be an amendment deadline on Tuesday. We hope to pass it out on Wednesday.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. And with that, members, we are adjourned.